This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Let me be explicit right now in this podcast. There's some explicit language. It's Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The tax plan is out. The tax plan is out. I feel so alive. CNN tweeted, read the full text, and provided a link. And of course, I had to wade in. I mean, how can we criticize our elected officials for not reading the bill if we don't read the bill? So went right in, skipped a page, ma'am, just chose 225, and here I found 1, operating a nursery or a sod farm, or 2, the raising or harvesting of trees bearing fruit, nut, or other crops or ornamental trees for purposes of subclause 2, an evergreen tree which is more than 6 years old at the time severed from the roots shall not be treated as an ornamental tree. Okay, I'm out. So let's call in an expert. Joining me now to play one question only tax edition, it's Adam Davidson. Adam is a writer for The New Yorker on economic issues. He's the founder of NPR's Planet Money. He's a friend of mine. Hello, Adam. How are you?
Hey, Mike.
So it's tax day. It's the day we figured out what would be in the tax bill. We got the brackets. It's like March Madness. We wait for our brackets, see where our team's going to play. This time we got the brackets. We know what income levels the brackets will be affixed to. They kept acting like that was a minor detail. That's like, that is the tax code. That's like most of the tax code. Okay, so here is my one question only. Is this a tax cut or cut, as Trump wanted to brand it? Or is this really, as they say, tax reform?
Easy. This is a tax cut. It is not tax reform. Tax reform would normally be what they call revenue neutral. It doesn't raise taxes. It doesn't lower taxes. It raises the same amount of taxes, but it fundamentally changes how taxes are raised. So, for example, one idea that a lot of experts would like is for the U.S. to shift from getting most of its income, tax income, through an income tax to getting most of its tax income through something like what almost every, I think every industrialized nation has, something like a value-added tax, which is basically a super fancy sales tax where the tax is raised incrementally as value is accumulated during the production process. That's a little complicated, but as a general rule, economists see that as less distortionary. It does less damage. The tax code isn't deciding who wins, who loses. Big problem. It hurts poor people because poor people tend to consume more of their income or all of their income, and so they're paying more tax. So you have to offset that. That's a conversation to have. Tax reform would be something really, really different. It's not next year you have a 1040 that has slightly different brackets. Tax reform would be fundamental change, and that's not what we have.
And we're not going to get there because it's too hard politically. The status quo has too much sway.
It's a disaster politically, even if you have, you know, like the famous 1986 Reagan and Tip O'Neill, you know,
yeah,
Democrat and Republican
along working
together, because our tax code does have real winners, and those real winners like being winners and they don't want to be losers. And so, for example, with a VAT, if you don't have an income tax, you don't have a home mortgage interest deduction write-off. You don't have the healthcare write-off. You don't have, there's a bunch of things that even regular middle-class people, leave aside oil and gas companies and others who have special tax treatment, won't get anymore. And those people will be mad because they don't get it anymore. So real tax reform is about as hard as it gets and doesn't seem like this was the year for it. Although there was like 2 minutes where Paul Ryan seemed to think it might happen back in before Trump was inaugurated.
You were slightly hopeful.
I mean, I'm not a big fan of Paul Ryan's specific proposal, but it seemed like for just a minute, like, oh, the Republicans have the House and the Senate and the White House, and maybe they could do like real reform that's revenue neutral. In other words, it doesn't lower tax, it doesn't pay off the rich people, but that was ridiculous.
Adam Davidson covers economics for The New Yorker, and he is a reformer with results, except he's reformed nothing and got no results. Thank you, Adam.
You're welcome, Mike.
On the show today, a spiel about what went wrong in protecting Americans from Russian exploitation of social media. The answer is other Americans, including a four-star American. But first, he is the voluble host of his own sports podcast. He is an acclaimed, or at least I think he's a pretty good actor. I don't want to really start anything with the guy because Michael Rappaport is now an author and his book has balls. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm now joined by Michael Rappaport. He is a star of over 60 films. He is out with a new book called This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Talking Trash. He's also the host of the I Am Rappaport podcast. What's up, Michael? Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I have to tell you, this year I did this thing. It was called the Upfronts, where we sell podcasts to advertisers. Uh-huh. And the year before, you had done it. You had hosted it. So they hired me to host it.
Okay.
And I said, so how was it? And people, the one comment I got, maybe by five or six people is, You said fuck a lot less than Rappaport did. That was the number one comment I got.
That's funny.
I'm like, is it good? Is it bad? They were like, just less, definitely less. And it's not like I didn't say fuck. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, mm-hmm, I said fuck. But apparently,
yeah,
you laid the fuck on it.
I gave him a few fucks. Because for podcasting, you know, for me, you know, it's such a sense of freedom for me and my podcast. And, you know, when I was at the podcast Upfronts, I've been to so many network television Upfronts, and they're terrible. they're fucking sleeping pills. So when I was like, I'm hosting the podcast Upfronts, like, this is like a liberated sort of medium.
Right, right.
So, you know, and I just think that, you know, the word in general, like curse words, especially if they're not directed at anybody, if you're just like, you know, this fucking that or this thing is shit, like, I feel like they have an overrated stigma on them.
Absolutely. As does the middle finger. Like, we've randomly chosen a finger to get offended at.
Yeah, yeah. And so I just think, like, sometimes, like, you know, cursing, I'm like, you never heard these words before, you never said these words before. So that's good. But I'm glad you were able to hold it together. I had a good time doing it.
I was very tempted to go off on a riff about how Will Chamberlain was overrated, or how, who do you say, Bethany Frankel is the Michael Jordan of the Housewives.
That's right.
But then I realized you probably did that the year before.
No. I was just up there riffing.
No, but that's that's your territory.
Yeah.
Your stick.
Yeah.
Bill Russell, actually, not Will Chamberlain. Do you think Will Chamberlain was properly rated?
I think that Will Chamberlain is a stick man. I think, you know, I have a chapter in the book, the first list of the great stick men of all time. And his numbers, because he had said that number of 20,000 women,
yeah,
And I said, he's the most scrutinized, analyzed stickman of all time because of the numbers. But that's the number he said, and he stuck to it till the day he died. So we have to let the man rest now.
I think that if he had said 10,000, it would be so much less scrutinized. Not because it's half the number, but there is a specificity to 20,000.
But Ric Flair just came out and said 10,000 women.
Mm-hmm.
The wrestler Ric Flair. And then people were doing the math like, yo, that's a lot of fucking. Like, to be with 10,000 women, that's a lot of sex. Like, there has to be... Like, it almost, like, that has to be, like, a full-time job. So I don't know. It just seems like a lot. But, you know, who's to say whether Wilt was making up his claim and the great Ric Flair, if he was over-exaggerating or not?
So reading the book, you get an impression, which wasn't surprising, that you were a troublesome kid. Not troubled.
Right.
You seemed happy.
Right.
Just like your point was to make everyone around you a little bit more miserable.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They were there for your entertainment.
I mean,
you even print the report card.
Yes.
Which says as much. He uses school as a place to play with his friends.
That's right.
And torture teachers.
That's right.
Okay. But an actor, a lot of actors have that and they find the thing they love. But from what I always hear is the most important part of acting is listening. So how'd you develop listening, reacting? How'd you develop that skill?
In order to be disruptive the way I was in school, now obviously I was a kid, so I don't look at it like this back then. I was just, you know, it was just a fire and fury. But I guess there's a certain amount of timing. And, you know, as far as acting, listening, you know, you know, that's something that you have to, it's like playing music. It's like even doing a podcast. Like, mm-hmm. if we're doing a podcast and like we're talking over each other and I'm not listening to you, you're not listening to me. And, you know, that there's timing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
For me, like specifically talking about like this, it's like, you know, sometimes you do interviews. I've been doing so many goddamn interviews for the book and I'm happy to do it. But like some of the interviews I'm flowing with them. And some of them, I'm not. Like, you know, I've done talk shows. Some of the talk shows, like, I'm flowing with them, right? And I never met them. It's just your rhythms. It's like if you're in, a jam band. So when you're acting, you know, there's a skill to listening. Film acting is different because, to be honest with you, most of film acting is you alone. You know, sometimes there's two shots, three shots, but inevitably there's going to be a close-up. So the listening part of it, you know, sometimes some actors will be like, just say the lines as written, or they don't care if even they're off camera.
You mean when you're giving them something to act off?
Film acting, because you're just sort of acting. A lot of times, film acting is to nothing. Now, you know, it's just to yourself. You're just performing for the camera. Now, I don't do that, and I think I'm a pretty good listener, but I think it's really just about rhythm and timing, you know, and as an actor, like it's a give and take, just like a podcast or a band, or like if you're playing catch with somebody and like, you know, you're going out and somebody's throwing the ball to you, you know, if they hit you in a certain space, like hit your hands at a certain time, same type of shit. It's just timing.
Were you a collaborative basketball player?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was definitely a very unselfish basketball player. And I was never as good as I wanted to be, but I played all the time. And
describe your game to me.
Could shoot well, pass, physical. And was definitely unselfish. Definitely, definitely unselfish. Like I played basketball the right way in whatever sort of level that I played at. I played the right way. I was a defer. Like I wasn't probably. I probably would have been a little better if I had like more of a scorer's mentality, which I understand now.
Well, it also, if you were a shooter who can defend, so if you were a wing who could defend, that's really valuable these days. Right?
I wouldn't say I could defend, but I would. Try to defend.
Well, that's at least in New York. The New York playgrounds have a reputation for great point guards and great passing, but maybe not the best defense.
Mm-mm.
Yeah,
definitely not.
But you won the All-Star Game Celebrity MVP. For your defense.
That's correct.
You shut Terrell Owens down.
That's a fact. It's documented. Okay. It's very, very. You could look it up anywhere you need to, and it's truth.
Did you scout him out? Did you go in? So he had won the MVP award like twice before.
Yes.
You go into the game.
I hit my first shot of the game.
Yeah.
My kids were there. I got the ball on the wing. Shot a three, and I was like, and I just felt good. And I was talking shit to Terrell Owens. And then literally the next time he got the ball, and I think it might have been that same time, he went up and tried to dunk the ball. Mm-hmm. And I stripped him, and I was like, I was just on for me. Like, I was just talking so much shit, and I was like, you ain't doing shit. You ain't scoring nothing. And I think he was like, what the fuck is going on? Because he was, like, still in the NFL, and he's, like, a high-level athlete. And I'm clearly not.
If you don't know, if people don't know, he's one of the greatest receivers of all time. He's physically dominant. He's probably 10 years younger than you.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I got in his head. Now, you know, like on a normal day, you know, he'd be able to take me. But that day, I was able to get in his head just a little bit and keep him on the wraps.
How do they decide who's on what team?
I think they just do it based on personalities. You know, you don't want to have too many actors on one team. You want to, you know, split up even and try to make the best game out of it.
Now, Bieber is really good.
I wouldn't say he's really good. He's really good for Justin Bieber.
He's real, right.
Like he's better than you think. He's scrappy. He's tough. And when he's playing basketball, he's just a dude playing basketball. Like, he doesn't really think too much of himself when he's playing ball. Like, he's playing.
It does seem you could out-physical him, though.
I could out-physical Justin Bieber, but it was hard to catch the little motherfucker. Like, he's like a Canadian jackrabbit. Like, it was hard to... He is quick, and he's elusive.
Wily. Yes.
Yes.
So I want to ask you this. Jerry Seinfeld has the joke about, at this point, rooting for sports team is like rooting for laundry. It's the uniform. Why are you still a Knicks fan?
It's my DNA. It's just my DNA.
But you don't like the owner.
I don't like the owner.
You, other than Porzingis, there's probably no one on the team you really
could give a shit about him.
There you go.
But this year I'm not going. I'm not going to the Madison Square Garden. Number one, I'm not going back into Madison Square Garden until Charles Oakley is allowed back in Madison Square Garden. And there's so many other things in the NBA to pay attention to get excited about, to put my energy into. For this year, like, I'm not getting emotionally involved with the Knicks. It's too frustrating. I'm embarrassed to be a Knicks fan. And this is the city game. You know, where we are right now in Brooklyn, if you walk out of this building in any direction, north, south, east, west, you're going to walk past a basketball court. Basketball is part of the fabric and the architecture of New York City. And the fact that our team is so shitty, and it's been so shitty, and it's not that we've just lost, it's the way we've lost. Like, the reason why the 90s Knicks are so beloved is because at least they lost and they went down on their shield. At least we lost with some character. At least those guys were our guys.
We are closer to the Barclays Center. So what about being a Nets fan?
I came out to my first game this season the other day. I was courtside with a Brooklyn Nets jersey on. I had a D'Angelo Russell jersey on. And the Knicks are playing the Nets tonight. I know this probably won't air tonight. And I can't wait I hope Brooklyn kicks their ass.
Do you live in New York or L.A.?
Mostly in L.A. Back and forth. I got a place in Manhattan.
Do you go to Lakers games or Clippers games?
Clippers games.
And do they hook you up there?
They hook me up there, too.
Yeah.
It's a tougher ticket to get, though, the really good seats, because a lot of us in L.A., a lot of A-level stars. So they might be like, well, if Leonardo's coming, you know, Rapport, you know, you're in the 10th row tonight.
But doesn't Leo know you're from Celebrity Basketball?
Yeah, that's my man. That's my man. But there's definitely like, it's more of like, there's a lot of people that want tickets in L.A.
Where's he on the stick man list?
Leonardo is the consummate stick man. He's the number one stick man right now. We just had to put a stick man down. John Stamos, underrated, under-heralded, fantastic stick man for years.
Yeah.
Just got engaged. So we had to announce the end of his reign as a stick man. This is the third one in the year. We had George Clooney.
Yeah.
We had Derek Jeter. And now Stamos. They say deaths come in threes.
Yeah.
So those are the three that have gone down. So Stamos, I'm announcing it here because I'm a fan of this podcast. Stamos, stick man down. Death comes in threes. So Jeter, Clooney, and Stamos. Three of the best of their generation.
Says the three quarters of the Mount Rushmore of stickmen. By the way, the Mount Rushmore of stickmen, it's not the heads on Mount Rushmore. It's not the heads they use, is what I'm saying.
No.
But, so when a stickman retires, like a Viking funeral, you send the loaf out on
an ice
floe?
Send him out to pasture. And we wished him well. You know what I mean? Like, they had a great run.
Michael Rapaport's an actor and director from, well, Dr. Dolittle 2 and 59 yes. other movies. And he also directed the 30 for 30, When the Garden Was Eden. His podcast is I Am Rapaport. And his new book is This Book Has Balls, Sports Rants from the MVP of Trash Talking. Good to meet you, Michael.
I appreciate you having me.
And now the spiel. Yesterday, the House Intel Committee conducted a second day of questioning of Facebook, Twitter, and Google executives. By executives, I mean lawyers. There were 2,700 fake Twitter accounts out there, be they from bot or troll. There were Facebook groups run by Russians, but pretending not to be Russian. Who are they pretending to be? Army of Jesus. South United, and of course, Woke Blacks. Woke Blacks, indeed. The groups sowed dissent, and in one case, featured an ad with Jesus boxing the devil, asking the Facebook reader, which side are you on? How that maps onto labeling China a currency manipulator, I don't exactly know, but apparently it did. It has become abundantly clear that the Russians were trying to affect our elections. Their propaganda coursed its way through our infamous collection of tubes. But there is an analogy to the Russian influence effort that I want to make that's not tube-based. It's this. The propaganda, the ads, the fake accounts, those are the pathogens. And the pathogens were flowing through the bloodstream. The bloodstream's the internet. So in biology, there's this concept of the blood-brain barrier. And you don't want to cross the blood-brain barrier. What keeps the rotten globules in the blood from infecting our nervous system? That's the blood-brain barrier. There needs to be a mechanism, and scientists actually study and they find certain kinds of bacteria that are the things that cross the blood-brain barrier. And they wonder and they hope and they research perhaps these bacteria can be combated or eradicated or isolated. Well, in our analogy, we have found the bacteria. The thing that crossed the blood-brain barrier, that took the propaganda coursing through the system and caused an infection, the name of that bacteria was Flynn and Conway and Donald Trump Jr. Here was Representative Jim Himes, Democrat of Connecticut, questioning Sean Edgett of Twitter about the difference between a troll and a bot.
So with a troll, it's a real human, but not necessarily a real human who we know who that individual is.
Typically, that's the behavior we see, yeah.
But the thing is, the trolls were known to us, and they weren't only operating from server farms in Russia. There was one who was named National Security Advisor. Just the retweets from the Russian-controlled GOP Tennessee account. And by the way, that name was full of underscores. You gotta watch out for underscores in a Twitter account. The official names hardly ever go with underscores. But anyway, General Flynn's retweeting from that one account alone were enough to infect the central nervous system of the body politics. The Daily Beast reported that just 3 days before the 2016 election, Flynn posted that a 10 GOP, that's the Tennessee GOP, fake account that the Russians controlled, he reposted that 10 GOP tweet, and he said it needed to be retweeted frequently. And a day before the election, still Daily Beast reporting, Flynn cited 10 GOP again, saying, "Real Donald Trump and Mike Pence will be our next POTUS and VP Otis, Vapotus." Flynn quoted Pamela Moore 13, another fake account controlled by the Russians, whose content, the content of that account, if he bothered to look, claimed to be a Texan who is pro-God but had a lot of xenophobic rants. Eric Trump retweeted 10 GOP. Roger Stone retweeted plenty of fake Russian accounts. Eric Trump's brother, Don Jr., frequently disseminated the fake Pamela Moore account via his Twitter account, and he frequently retweeted the fake Tennessee GOP account. Here was one retweet at Tennessee GOP breaking. Thousands of names changed on voter rolls in Indiana. Police investigating. Hashtag voter fraud. Hashtag drain the swamp. All nonsense, all propaganda. Without the Trump acolytes, employees, and family members, the Russian social media efforts would have been stripped of a lot of their potency. Of course, that they weren't only served the interests of those spreading the lies. Yesterday, during the hearing, Facebook's lawyer talked about some safeguards his company put in place.
We've tried to provide notification broadly about the issue through our public blogs, and we have a hard questions blog on our website that addresses a lot of this, and we're committed to working with the committee to publicize all of the content we've seen.
Now, the problem with that is it assumes the social media user wants to know that he or she is being lied to, and that if they did know, they'd change their behavior. But in the case of just a couple of notable customers out of the billions of customers these companies have, the customers named Flynn, Stone, Conway, and Trump, the last thing they wanted was to be informed of the truth, or for the rest of us to be either. And that's it for today's show that just was produced by Dan Schrader, who's part of the totally non-Russian Facebook group Shit Borscht Eaters Say. Just producer Mary Wilson knew that one Twitter account she follows was a mix of scurrilous allegations of Hillary Clinton interposed with dash cam vids of comets and small bears drowning vodka. Very curious. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, calls foul on that one Russian Twitter account when he discovered that its blue check mark was actually a series of smaller blue check marks, each contained in the last one. The Gist, and all users who are wondering if The Gist ever disseminates information from a foreign government, they could just consult our FAQ. It's under Is Mike Being Controlled by a Foreign Power? Just click the link, enter your social, and we'll be glad to respond. Oompru depru dupru, and thanks for listening.
And can I just say,
yeah,
in reference to you selling me, my tax accountant, the very wonderful Maria Ivanis, every time she sees me published or on TV as a financial expert, she says she just laughs her head off. If they actually knew how crappy he was at his personal finances.
The guy once tried to deduct a cockroach as livestock.